Well, as I said earlier in my prayers just then, I was speaking about praying about Kate Forbes, the Scottish finance minister, who recently in her bid to become the next Scottish first minister has been under fire for her Christian views, her views on same-sex relationships, views on transgenderism, views on having children before marriage and all sorts of things like that. And while I think that her ability to hold her own on these views has been respected by many, many in the media have seen her integrity in that respect, at the same time, we can't avoid the fact that this once again is yet one more proof that being a Christian and holding basic Christian teachings is viewed today by many as strange and unacceptable. Certainly unacceptable in the political arena. Kate Forbes is seen as an extremist. And so what are the implications of that for ourselves? Well, in all likelihood, as time goes on, our views as Christians are going to seem stranger and stranger for most people and more unacceptable. More and more we will find ourselves on the receiving end of loaded questions and cunning objections and attempts to impugn our characters. Maybe you feel the heat of that already in your daily lives. So how do we respond to those kinds of objections? How do we respond to the pointed questions and the criticisms? Well, I think that Mark chapter 10 and those few verses we read earlier go some way in helping us out in that respect. You see, here, it's Jesus who is finding himself at the end of a hostile interview. I know he's only asked one question by these Pharisees, but it's there to test him. It's a loaded question. It's designed to trap him. And so I think then, surely we have every right to look at this passage, to study how Jesus, our great example, and that is who he is our example, how he responds to this kind of interrogation, and to ask ourselves then, is there anything we can learn from his response? That's the approach I'm going to take in this sermon this evening. It's not an approach that I take very much, but that's the approach I'm taking. How can we imitate Jesus as he is taken to task by those in his world and as we are taken to task in our own world? And I have three basic answers to that question. And instead of points 1, 2, and 3, I'm going to label my points A, B, and C. And that should be, why I'm doing that should be clear in a moment. So A, point A, be aware. Be aware. The Pharisees, as I say, want to test Jesus. How do they imagine the next few moments to unfold? Well, probably something like this. The Pharisees ask Jesus, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife? That's the question they're going to ask. And they're restricting Jesus there to a yes or a no answer. Now, Jesus could say, yes, divorce is lawful. But in that case, he would be contradicting something he has said earlier. Earlier in his ministry on the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5, Jesus had preached against divorce. And presumably then we can expect that these Pharisees know about that and they're expecting him now to say, no, divorce is not lawful. Indeed, these Pharisees aren't just expecting Jesus to take that position, they're positively hoping he'll take that position. They want Jesus to say that for the simple reason that they have a pre-planned put-down, I think. What they will do is they will play the Moses card. They will whip out Deuteronomy chapter 24. Haven't you read Deuteronomy chapter 24, Jesus? They'll say. In that chapter, it talks about the case of a man who gives his wife, quote, a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house. And yes, of course, Jesus might be able to conjure up an argument or two in response to that, but at the very least, at that point, they will have drawn him out into the long grass and they will have made him feel very hot under the collar. And they will have undermined something of his authority in the presence of all those crowds he is currently teaching. And people will look upon Jesus and they'll think to themselves, well, Jesus is clearly muddled here about the law of Moses. Jesus doesn't know the law of Moses, at least as well as the Pharisees do. Even better, perhaps they will come away from this thinking Jesus is just not on side with Moses then. Jesus is drawing people away from Moses, our great father. That's the message that these Pharisees want to prevail in this test. That's how they hope the next few moments will unfold. But that's not how the next few moments do unfold. In fact, the way that Jesus responds to their question here indicates that he knows full well what the Pharisees are up to. He is well aware of what they're doing in this encounter. And that's evident in the fact that the Pharisees are not the first people to bring up Moses in this passage. Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife, they ask. Jesus answers them, what did Moses command you? What did Moses command you? Jesus brings Moses up first. Jesus plays the Moses card before they can. Jesus goes precisely to the place where they were most wanting him to wriggle away from, the law of Moses. And by doing that, he's making it clear right from the very beginning that he is totally unashamed of Moses and his law. What did Moses command you? He asks them. He's aware of what's going on, and he beats them to it. And indeed, the question Jesus asks there, what did Moses command you, is an ingenious question. It's ingenious because whatever you might argue from the law of Moses, you could not possibly argue that Moses commanded the right to have a divorce. And the Pharisees knew that. Because as they respond, Moses allowed a man to write a certificate of divorce, they say in verse 4. And by saying that, then they really make Jesus' point for him. Divorce is not commanded in the law, it's an allowance. It is a permission. In other words, divorce was part of a fallen society that the law of God graciously accommodated itself to, adapted to, made allowances for. Jesus said to them, because of your hardness of heart, he wrote you this commandment. That's the point. On my walk up to the seminary in the morning, I walk up Matthew Bank. And running up along the bank on my left, between me and Jesmond Dean, is a series of long metal railings. And you look at the railings and you see how the plants have adapted and worked best around those railings. You see that the ivy and the holly and the beech branches all cleverly sort of weaving their way through, accommodating to those stiff metal bars. Without compromising their own integrity as plants, they have adapted to their circumstances. It's quite intelligent, really. And the civil law of Israel was a little bit like that. It weaved around the circumstances of an ancient Israelite context and a fallen Israelite context. Yes, the law's principles were absolutely divine. They were never morally compromised, but they were also realistic in a sense. They simply couldn't just push down those metal bars. Instead, they chose to work around them, to work around the obstacle of the human heart. And in places then, they made accommodations and allowances. And in this case, in Deuteronomy 24, it made allowances for the reality of divorce. Israelite society wouldn't be able to cope with a strict divorce law. They were a hard-hearted society, Jesus says. And that was a problem that the law alone couldn't fix, and so it made allowances for that. Moses allowed a certificate of divorce. The way that Jesus speaks here is quite strong, isn't it? He says, because of your hardness of heart, he says to the Pharisees. In other words, he's identifying those Pharisees with that hard-hearted society. These Pharisees are not the defenders of the law that they like to think of themselves to. Instead, they are like those stiff metal railings that the law had to awkwardly accommodate to. If anything, they were the impediment to the law. They were the ones whose hard-heartedness, whose resistance to the law, was so stubborn, so prolonged, so rigid, that in the end the law bent around them. You see, these Pharisees, they want to portray this whole thing right from the beginning as Jesus on the one side, and Moses, and the law, and the Pharisees on the other side. But before these Pharisees are even able to make that argument, Jesus has already spun the tables round the other way. No, it's the Pharisees on the one side, and it's Moses, the law, and Jesus on the other. And all of this really at this point is just simply to say that Jesus doesn't fall for their trap. No, right from the beginning, he is aware of the threat that they're making. He has seen through their devices, and he refuses to be drawn in the direction that they're taking him. He is aware of what's going on. That's an important principle in this interaction. It's a very simple principle, but it's a principle I think we can learn a lot from. Now, obviously my application of this evening is not be as ingenious as Jesus is. It's not always outsmart your opponents. It's not always have the right response to their questions. No, that would be an unrealistic thing for me to ask of you. But there's a more general principle of that than that. A principle perhaps you think is too general, but nevertheless it's a principle that we find in the scriptures. Enter into these interactions with your neighbours with awareness. We find this principle in the writings of the Apostle Peter, don't we? Peter says, always be prepared to make a defence to anyone who asks you for a reason of the hope that is in you. In other words, do not involve yourself in these contentions casually. Be thoughtful about it. Be prepared, perhaps long in advance. Be lucid about it. Do it carefully, with full awareness, making preparations. I think Peter knows just how well that principle served Jesus in interactions like these. He saw that principle operating in Jesus' life, and so he commands his readers to put it into practice in their own. I think as for Jesus, I think in all probability, he is a man who is acting and speaking with a mind furnished with those proverbs of the Old Testament. Proverbs like Proverbs 15:28, the heart of the righteous ponders how to answer, but the mouth of the wicked pours out evil things. Or Proverbs 17:27, whoever restrains his words has knowledge, and he who has a cool spirit is a man of understanding. Jesus would have stored up those proverbs in his mind, and he puts them perfectly into practice in his interactions in his ministry. He does keep his cool, doesn't he? He does limit his words. He chooses them carefully and thoughtfully. He remains totally lucid and aware of what's going on. And so that's the principle I just simply at this point want to put before you this evening. Be aware. Be aware of who you're speaking to. Be aware of where you're being led in your conversations. Be aware of what you're saying and who you're saying it to. When you're confronted about your faith, when you're speaking about your faith in public or with those in your workplace or whoever it might be, do it consciously. Do it with awareness. Be aware. It is embarrassing, isn't it, to see Christians at times just sort of arguing away as if it's some kind of mindless activity, as if they can do it as casually as if they're mowing the lawn or whistling a tune. And then, you know, these people find themselves often mindlessly arguing themselves into all sorts of traps which have been set for them. And they end up looking foolish. I guess we've all been there at some point ourselves, to argue and argue until we feel like we realize we've argued ourselves into a corner and we're stuck and we're not even convinced by what we're saying anymore. Well, we shouldn't be like that. For the sake of the gospel, that's not a good place to be. It's not responsible to have that attitude. Don't be like that. No, take it seriously when the world takes you to task. Slow down, take it carefully and cautiously. Be prepared and be aware. So that's my first point. Be aware. Secondly, point B, think big. A, be aware. B, think big. Now, as you well know, that by Jesus' day, there were an awful lot of extra teachings which had grown up alongside the law of Moses. And in some ways, those teachings were only logical. You know, a passage like Deuteronomy 24 was confusing to some people. It raised questions about the nature of divorce. And so scribes discussed back and forth with each other for generations what these passages meant. And on this particular issue of divorce, people had argued from all sorts of positions. Some people had a very narrow view of what was acceptable. Others took a more liberal position. And many people in Jesus' day were effectively arguing for a no-fault divorce system. That's the view they took of the issue of divorce. Now, Jesus, he could have been very easily drawn into those legal debates. arguing back and forth with the scribes about what was precisely meant by the legislation of Deuteronomy 24. And probably that's what these Pharisees were hoping for. But I want you to see that from verse 6 of our passage, Jesus makes a complete departure from the whole issue of the law. Jesus makes a whole departure from the whole question of the law of Moses. You see, Jesus is now speaking in the front of all of these crowds. And to find himself there arguing over legal technicalities would not be a helpful approach, at least not for their sakes. And for that reason, then, Jesus now steers this whole conversation somewhere else. It's not that he's evasive. It's not that he dodges their questions. It's not that he acts like a politician does. But rather, he addresses their questions at a deeper level. He opens up for us the bigger picture with regards to marriage and divorce, such that he can answer their question. So instead of talking about Moses, in verse 6, Jesus now starts to talk about the beginning of creation. He doesn't want to discuss the technicalities of the law, of a law that made accommodations for hard-hearted, sinful people. Rather, he wants to talk about the law in its original state, as it was primitively from the beginning. He wants to take us to God's law as it was meant to be from the very start, in perfect, sinless Eden, where it had no impediment, no obstacle in the human heart, and where God's design had free sway. That's where he wants to take us. To return back to my illustration I mentioned earlier, when I'm walking up Matthew Bank, I'm peering at those railings and seeing the vines and the branches tangling around the railings. You can't help but allow those branches to draw you back behind the railings. You trace back those branches to their origin. And what do you see when you focus behind the railings? Well, you see a sort of thriving garden of vegetation. Big, thick tree trunks and beeches and ash trees and conifers and hollies. And they're all unimpeded and they're free and they're luscious. Well, here in this passage, Jesus, as it were, looks behind the railings and onto the trees. He looks into the Garden of Eden, where the law of God thrived naturally, where the principles of human purpose and prosperity were first established without accommodation to hard-heartedness. And there, within that perfect garden, he sees the original design for marriage, and he directs our minds then towards that, away from the mere allowance of divorce that the Pharisees want to talk about. No, he shifts our focus off the railings and upon the trees behind the railings. And what then does he teach us about God's original design for marriage? Well, actually, to the shame of these Pharisees, pretty much everything Jesus says from verses 6 to 8 is simply quoting from Genesis 2. A book which was written by Moses. It's not as if Jesus is saying anything original here. Nevertheless, through those quotations alone, he takes our mind into higher, better, fresher planes. He takes our mind into God's purposes for marriage from the beginning. And he shows us then that when we look at the big picture, we see that marriage was never just about bits of paper, legal contracts, certificates passing back and forth, nor was it about changing romantic appetites. No, back in the garden, in the original state, marriage was something much more profound in its purpose than that. At the heart of every marriage was supposed to be the inseparable melding together of two people into one flesh. God made them male and female, he says. Therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and shall hold fast to his wife, and should become one flesh. This deep mingling together of human souls and this determined faithfulness, one holding fast to the other against all the odds until the very end, only dissolved in a fallen world by death itself. It's idealistic, you might say. Yes, it is, but it's God's ideal for mankind. And while hard-hearted people might resist that ideal at all costs and hope for the possibility of divorce, for the follower of Jesus Christ, that ideal is lovely and good and something to be embraced. And so Jesus is saying to these Pharisees, for the follower of me, marriage is a serious thing because it's a profoundly good and beautiful thing. He goes on to speak to these disciples in private, and in verse 11 he tells them that ultimately to think lightly of marriage has terrible consequences. Jesus tells his disciples that a society where divorce is a small matter and one can simply divorce another and remarry another, divorce one person and remarry another, that's a society in effect of adulterers. That's a strong word from Jesus, but that's what he says. A society which has become so obsessed with reading into Deuteronomy 24 that it hasn't even noticed it's abandoned the seventh commandment. A society where one man commits adultery against his wife and a wife against her husband. It's an unstable and chaotic society set against itself. A society where a man no longer leaves his father and mother and holds fast to his wife, but rather leaves multiple fathers or multiple mothers and then holds only lightly to a series of wives. That's not a good place to be in. And that's not what Jesus' people want, Jesus is saying. No, we don't want to spend our lives living within the crevice of some allowance within the law or some permission within the law. No, we want something better than that. We want the law as it was supposed to be, God's purposes as they were set out in Eden. We want the original design. We're committed to that. And yes, we understand the world is a complicated and messy place, and you can rightly debate what Deuteronomy 24 is saying for as long as you like, but the bottom line is that in all of that, we love the law of God above all things, and we believe that's best, and that's the big picture Jesus takes them to. And it strikes me then that there is a principle for us in all of this. The principle is that when we are confronted about our stand on some moral issue, we should think big. That is, we should go to the big picture. Think about how Jesus responds to other tests and questions he's asked in the Gospels. Think about Jesus being tested on the issue of the Sabbath. Will Jesus heal this man with a withered hand? The scribes wonder. Why do Jesus' disciples pluck the grain? He's asked. And he responds to those situations by referring once again to the big picture. He asks, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good? He says, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. The point is, instead of getting lost in detailed legislation, no, he draws back the thinking to the origin of the and the purpose of the Sabbath. That's what Jesus wants to do. He looks to the big picture. Or think of an occasion where Jesus is asked by the Pharisees for a sign. He could have just offered them a sign. He could have performed any miracle to please them. But instead of acting on their terms, he responds by questioning their very need for a sign. A wicked and adulterous generation asks for a sign, he says. That is, Jesus opens up once again the bigger picture. He asks the big question, what sort of a person would desire a sign in the first place? What does that say about you? And that's typical of Jesus. Most of the responses that he gives to questions in the Gospels usually can be reduced to just one or two big statements which get to the heart of the matter. Now, again, I'm not suggesting that you speak with the same depth and ingenuity that Jesus does, but what I do suggest is that you keep your picture big as you have these discussions with your neighbours. You are a Christian, after all. That means your whole worldview is fundamentally different to those of other people's. Don't feel constrained to argue and discuss on their terms. Let me give you a modern example. So imagine you're asked a question about whether you think gay people should have the right to get married. Now, you could answer that question on the terms it was asked and simply say, no, they don't, and leave it at that. The problem is, by answering the question on those terms, you've probably laid all sorts of misunderstandings in the minds of those who are listening to you. Probably people will come away from that thinking that what you said is that gay people don't deserve to be married. That your objection to gay marriage then is based on some prejudice you have against a certain kind of person. No, it's better, I think, to respond to that kind of question by asking maybe a bigger question. Asking, what is marriage? What makes marriage distinct from other relationships? And then to go on to explain that it's your conviction that marriage is the union of the sexes, the foundation of the family. In other words, it's not that gay people don't deserve to be married. Actually, it's got very little to do with gay people at all. Rather, the bare fact of the matter is that two people of the same sex cannot be united in the same way that a man and a woman can. Same-sex marriage is a contradiction in terms. It's a meaningless concept. Now, maybe you think that's a bit of a complicated approach. Maybe you think it is easier just to say, no, they shouldn't be able to marry. Well, fair enough, even if you think that. Even if you do think that, I would suggest, though, that you do still in some way open up the bigger picture. Introduce them to the bigger landscape around you. Make it clear to these people why it is you think that. Say to them, look, ultimately my conviction is that God's design for human relationships is good, even when it involves difficult personal sacrifice. It usually does involve sacrifice in this fallen world, sacrifice for us as well as others. Now maybe you think that sounds very basic, but actually I think for many people that they're not thinking in that way, they're not thinking on that level. And that might a statement like that might just reorient the whole conversation. It might just bring it back to the basics and allow you to discuss the issue in a more fruitful way, allowing yourself to be more clearly understood. To say, look, I admit there are complicated issues, but the bottom line is I love God and I believe his way is best. Don't be hemmed in by the questions you're asked. Think big in your responses. So my first point, be aware. My second point, think big. A, B, and thirdly, C, speak courageously. That's my third point. Speak courageously. It's not fashionable to have socially conservative views on marriage and sexuality in the 21st century, but it's something of a comfort to realise that this passage reminds us that having conservative views on marriage and sexuality hasn't necessarily ever been popular. Jesus' followers in his day are accused of being illiberal and narrow, even by Pharisees, who you'd think would be the most illiberal and narrow people there are. And their reason then for asking Jesus this question, we're not given a clear reason for them asking this question, but we might fairly deduce that they want him to walk over certain tripwires which have been set for him. You see, at the end of the day, these Pharisees, they saw Jesus as a political threat. They wanted to scupper his chances of advancing himself any further. And so they wanted him to say things that would make him look unpopular to ordinary people, make him look like a religious extremist. They wanted to dirty his name and his reputation in the public square. They hoped that there were people in those crowds who had so far seen Jesus as an attractive countercultural icon, now would be exposed to his sort of real hardline opinions. And that would be too much for them and they'd leave at that point. Perhaps people like the Samaritan woman in John chapter 4, or the woman caught in adultery in John chapter 8, or all those other sinners that Jesus had previously spent so much time with, surely these people, these Pharisees may have reasoned, would no longer feel the love of Jesus now. Now they could see his real bigotry, his real beliefs about marriage. No, instead they'd feel judged by Jesus and rejected by Jesus. They'd feel like a sinner in the eyes of Jesus and they'd back off and withdraw from their teacher. Perhaps that's what these Pharisees wanted to happen. Perhaps they were hoping for even worse consequences than that. These Pharisees knew that not long ago, John the Baptist had been executed. And for what reason had John been executed? Well, essentially, for speaking out on issues of sexual ethics. He'd accused Herod of adultery, of taking his brother's wife. And that had seen the end of John. It's not too far-fetched then to suppose that these Pharisees are trying to draw Jesus down that kind of line, to put him in those dangerous, controversial waters, to stir up Herod's anxieties and then see the end of Jesus as well. And I suppose then my point at this point is simply that there is a real sense in which Jesus' options at this point in the conversation are limited. At a purely human level, he cannot give the perfect answer to their question. He cannot leave everyone satisfied. The nature of the situation is that some people will be offended. Some people will be left angry about Jesus' teachings on divorce. It may well be the case that these teachings of his will be heard by Herod in his courts. And yet, the thing is that despite all of those concerns being real in Jesus' eyes, they cannot override his commitment to truth and the word of God. To Jesus, keeping the peace was important. To Jesus, avoiding misunderstanding was important. To Jesus, revealing these hard issues at a careful, gradual pace to his followers was important. But none of those things could be allowed to compromise Jesus' commitment to truth. And that is why then, that when it comes to it, Jesus just says what is right, even though it comes at a price. He says that divorce is wrong. In fact, he says something stronger than that, doesn't he? I mean, for one thing, he has already said privately that those who promote this culture of divorce are really promoting a culture of adultery. But arguably, I think what he says publicly is even stronger than that. Those strong words, "What therefore God has joined together, let not man separate." He's accusing those who promote divorce of tearing apart God's good design. That's a strong accusation. It's an accusation of murder of sorts, isn't it? Because if husband and wife are one fused flesh, one intermingled, indivisible unit, which can't be prized apart naturally, then breaking that bond is only possible through an act of great violence. To divide a marriage is to rip apart one living organism. And for that reason, then, virtually every divorce, Jesus is saying, involves a horrible violence. There's a sin involved. Somebody is culpable. Those words are hard on modern ears. They were hard on ancient ears. But the moment demands that Jesus speaks truthfully, and so he says them. Divorce is wrong. And bringing it back to my heading then, the point is that Jesus' stance on this issue of truth demands courage. Jesus realizes that the moment he opens his mouth, the facial expressions of those he's speaking to will probably change. He will see disappointment in their eyes and disbelief and fury in their eyes. And large portions of his crowd might well disappear. And Herod might well soon find out about this. And he looks at those Pharisees and a smirk appears across their faces as they realize Jesus' ministry has taken a blow. And in part, then, they have succeeded. Yes, Jesus can beautifully weave his way around these tests, but his ministry doesn't remain undamaged. No, there's always a cost involved. Answering their questions honestly is always going to be a hard thing which demands courage from Jesus. And very little has changed in our world today. In the case of someone like Kate Forbes, the costs are particularly high, aren't they? She knows full well that whatever she says in her interviews will define her career and her public reputation forever onwards. And she knows that even the most couched, the most qualified, the most carefully stated position will soon be reduced to a headline in a newspaper or the title of a YouTube video, which people will derive all sorts of misunderstandings from. That's unavoidable as far as she's concerned. To speak truth under her conditions requires enormous courage. But it's the same for people like you and I. In the workplace, in the school playground, to our friends and neighbours, on the internet, there's a cost involved. There are certain situations where we will feel that cost very keenly, and it will not be avoidable. The need for courage is absolutely necessary. So where do we find that courage then? How do we take that stand? Well, where does Jesus find his courage in this passage? Well, I think it comes from the fact that Jesus knows that however unpopular his views might be on this issue, and however lonely he might feel in taking his position, he is not alone ultimately. No, Jesus is on God's side. After all, it was God, he tells us, who made male and female in verse 6. What therefore God has joined together, let man not separate. At the end of the day, there are two sides to these issues. There is the side of God, who creates and joins together in a state of perfection in the beginning. And there's the side of man, who rips apart God's good design. And as hard as it might be in the face of all those crowds and those Pharisees, Jesus knows whose side he is better off taking. And it's God's side. And that then, I think, is his source of courage. And it should be our source of courage as well. And so I end this evening by directing you to that source, to that well, that fountain of courage. By directing you to that. And say, find your courage in knowing that you take your stand with God. You're in a common room, say, surrounded by work colleagues, and one of them says to you, isn't it really good to see that the Church of England is finally blessing same-sex marriage, same-sex relationships? Or you're in a job interview, and the interviewer says to you, I heard you're a Christian. You're not one of those pro-life Christians, are you? Or you're out with a group of friends, and one of them says to you, isn't it really good that so-and-so finally got out of that marriage and had that divorce? And you consider your response to those questions. And on the one side, you see the majority view. You see the multitudes of men and women calling you over to side with them. And you don't want to make them unhappy. You don't want to make them cross. You don't want to be a pariah. You don't want to be seen as a bigot. You want to do the reasonable, the kind, the accepting thing. And it's so tempting just to agree with them. Well, in that moment, I encourage you to look at the other side. And as lonely as you might feel taking that position, that stance of truth, see that on your side is none other than God, the true God, the living God, the good God, who determines what is best, who can be trusted even when we don't understand, and who will give you strength to make those stands. And I'm saying then, stand with him, side with him. Yes, be aware of where the conversation is going, be aware and proceed carefully. Yes, think big about how you can best answer their questions in a way which makes the most sense. But before all of that, take courage. Let God be your guide and your companion. Echo his words, speak his truth, and take courage in him. Amen.